Happy New Year! Welcome to Council Connection. I'm your host, Steve Dresser. It's the first show of 2018, and we're in the grip of a New England winter, the likes of which we haven't seen in a while. We've got snow up to our knees, and the temperatures are falling into the single digits as we speak. But nevertheless, Council Connection is here, and we're ready to hit the ground running for 2018. This month, Hannah Fairbairn will be here to tell us about her latest book, and we'll begin the show with some exciting news about a new Bay State chapter. Here's Frank Ventura to tell us more. Well, Happy New Year, Frank, and welcome to Council Connection. You're the first guest of 2018.
Thank you very much, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here, as usual, and I hope you have a nice warm heater going there in the studio tonight.
Well, it is, and as long as the power doesn't fail, we should be fine. And, hopefully will not be a problem. I'm pretty lucky here in Reading that it usually doesn't happen that way, except in the summertime. Anyway, we're not here to talk about power. We are here to talk about the newest of Bay State Council of the Blind's chapters, which is the Boston chapter. So I guess it's been kind of a long time coming, hasn't it?
It has. This is originally envisioned a couple of years ago, and through a bunch of logistical and communications snafus and life getting in the way in general, it's been kind of postponed. It took a little while to get going. We've had a lot of interest in it. One of the toughest things, and we'll talk about this a little more later on, but one of the hardest things to do is actually sometimes just find a physical location for a meeting.
But I guess you did overcome all of that, and you did find a place for the meeting.
Yes, due to hard work of some of our members, we actually did find a location, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that later. But I just want to first say how proud I am that finally our capital city is going to be well represented with a chapter of its own. I know a lot of people, when they think Massachusetts, they think Boston. So it's a big boost to the identity of our organization. So I just wanted to talk a little about where we stand with the chapter. So we have a good amount of members, and just so people know what it takes to create a chapter, you need to have seven members, at least seven members to start
right.
The chapter. I mean, that number can fluctuate up and down. Hopefully it goes up, not down.
Yes.
But that's the number you need to start the chapter. And we did have that. We do have that, I should say. And we did petition the board of directors of Bay State to become an official chapter. And we are now an official chapter.
Yeah, and that was decided, I think, was it November?
I believe so.
And I believe that you've already had at least one meeting. Well, you had to have one meeting, I guess, to decide that you were, in fact, an official or ready to go to the board.
We did have one meeting, which is really just a planning meeting, just to throw ideas out there to see how much interest it is and what kind of things we wanted to do. I think one of the things that everyone kind of was on board with was that when many people, you know, both sighted and blind alike, obviously visit Massachusetts, you know, one of the things they'll do is visit Boston, and we were thinking, you know, how good it would be that we could get together as a chapter and create maybe a resource for local knowledge for blind travelers to our great city.
You have your officers in place and the Constitution. Is that all taken care of now, too, or not?
No, actually, it's not. There's only one officer at this point, which is myself. I'm the interim president.
Okay.
And let me tell you a little bit about the upcoming meeting. You'll understand where we stand. Right now, our upcoming meeting, which will be this coming Saturday, which is the 6th,
yep,
at the Roxbury YMCA at 285 Martin Luther King Boulevard, Roxbury, from 1 to 3. Two other things on the agenda, and I'm kind of working backwards here through the agenda. The last item is going to be to form a committee to create a constitution.
Okay.
So, and we don't have one yet, but we'll form that committee, and we'll see who volunteers for that to be, yeah. And that would be one of our objectives. Moving forward, will be in the agenda will be the election of officers. And since we don't have a standing constitution, we'll have to adopt standing rules of the election process at the meeting itself. Right. So we're looking at three basic positions: a president, a vice president, and a treasurer. And certainly one person could hold more than one position. I don't foresee someone holding president and vice president simultaneously, but someone could conceivably be president and treasurer or vice president and treasurer at the same time. Yeah.
Now, it's interesting you didn't mention a secretary, and usually that's also, or at least in many chapters, that's a function as well, because somebody has to record the minutes.
This is true, yeah. I mean, again, like, these may be functions, this may be, you know, dictated by what comes out of our Constitution, and that is one of the questions we have to pose to ourselves.
Right.
What will happen in that regard.
And, of course, as you say, it depends on who is willing to do what. And if nobody comes forward, then things will be done a little differently, I guess.
So with that said, let me tell you about our feature presentation at this week's meeting.
Okay.
When we had a planning meeting, I kind of like did an informal survey, and I found out that only a few people at the planning meeting actually have ever been to an ACB National Convention. So we kind of thought it may be a good idea to hold a little symposium about what it's really like to attend an ACB National Convention. And we're very proud and very thankful that our very own Mr. Rick Morgan, who we know as our Bay State Treasurer, but also holds another hat as the head of the audio visual services for the National Conventions, can tell us a little bit about what it's like to go to the convention and give us a little bit of a sneak preview of what's coming up in July. And the reason that we're going to be talking about this now in January, which I know you don't want to think about July when it's 0 degrees out, but it takes a lot of advanced planning and not just planning, but sometimes even saving to make it possible for someone to go to a convention. I know I'm already starting to look at who, what, where, how, and why that will get me to the convention this summer. So I thought this was a timely topic for this time of year.
I think it absolutely is. And, you know, it'll be as you say, it'll be a far different weather-wise situation by the time we all get out to St. Louis. But for now, it's good to plan, and it's not cheap. I mean, it's worth it, but it does cost. And if you're a little bit short of money, then you really do have to start planning. And some people even start planning at the end of the previous convention for the next one.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's an unfortunate side effect of, you know, the world we live in, that, yeah, it is very difficult for many people to attend the convention. So, like you said, the only remedy we have at this point right now is good planning. Yeah.
Yep, exactly. And so will anything else be happening at this meeting?
Well, again, you know, other than that, it's going to be open topic. So, you know, if you want to find out what goes on, you know where to find us.
That's right. So if anybody is interested in joining this chapter, I guess you would probably be the primary contact person?
First, you can always reach me at my cell phone. That's 781-492-4262, or my email address, frank@riverbreezes.com. And one other thing, too, we also have an email list for the Bay State chapter, and it's hosted on free lists right now. You could obviously subscribe to that as well. If you want to get on that, you can drop me a note and I can get anybody on that. It's open to anyone who has an interest in the chapter.
Okay. And again, I think probably the smartest thing to do if you've got questions of any kind is talk to Frank. Because you are the man, Frank.
Thank you. Now, there's a lot of people who have made this happen, a lot of hard-working people.
Well, Frank, it's great thing that's going on here. I'm glad to see that Boston is now going to be formally represented in BSCB. We've always been there to some extent, but not formally. And I think it's high time that that's happened. And I wish you good luck with all of the plans for the new chapter.
Thank you so much, Steve. And as always, it's a pleasure to be on Council Connection.
Once again, the Boston chapter of Bay State will be meeting on this Saturday, January 6th. From 1 to 3 p.m. at the Roxbury YMCA at 285 Martin Luther King Boulevard in Roxbury. You're listening to Council Connection on the Talking Information Center Network. The show also airs on the second Tuesday of the month on ACB Radio Mainstream at 9 p.m. Eastern. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit www.acbfma.org and look for the Council Connection. In addition to working as an instructor at the Carroll Center for the Blind in Newton, Hannah Fairbairn has written several books on the subject of vision loss. Here she is to tell us about her latest endeavor.
The title of the book is When You Can't Believe Your Eyes, and the subtitle is Vision Loss and Personal Recovery. And it will be published in about a year from now, or it might be in the early spring of 2019. That's the general idea. So that's the book. I should tell you why I thought that I should write such a book. So it's been striking me since way back that it would be terrific to have a book that was a self-help book for people who were losing their vision, a how-to book. Because one of the really annoying things about losing your vision is that unless you're kind of fortunate, you spend a long time being told about your condition by people who see. And I thought that given what a loss of confidence can come and loss of self-esteem can come with loss of sight, I thought the fact that you couldn't read for yourself to get information about how to and self-help was kind of another puncture to your self-esteem and your confidence. And then while I was sort of thinking about it, and I should also at this point give a shout out that between for about not quite a year from 2007 to 2008, I had a terrific focus group, and they came to the house about once a month, and they would give all kinds of different points of view, different levels on types of vision loss about subjects that I chose and some subjects that they chose. So it would be like things as obvious as going shopping, and then things kind of less obvious, like what to do with your family if they were doing too much for you or being really annoying in the way that they tried to help you. Then we also had a lively session on toilets and another session, so important and doesn't get talked about enough. And travel, how to travel independently, so on. Various stuff about social events. So this is a terrific focus group. Then, of course, in 2009, the iPhone was launched. And soon after that, it became clear that this was a revolution in how people could read. And while it still obviously takes a lot of learning to use to read a book on Google Play, it's nothing like the amount of learning that was needed before smart devices. So it is now reasonable to think that people who have fairly recently lost sight can read a how-to book. I don't want to go on too much about that, but anyway, so finally, after I was going to talk about why I'm writing this. So I was born with congenital cataract, so I went through the school system way back in the 50s and 60s, and this was in Britain, with no accommodations and no understanding that someone with partial sight would have social difficulties. And then when I was 33, overnight, I lost the sight in my good eye, and now I see outlines and shapes and colors, and I have something like 2400, 2600 vision, which is very useful for some kinds of navigation. And then our second daughter was born and inherited my eye condition. So she went through the public school system with a vision teacher. And then I taught for 18 years here at the Carroll Center. I retired last year. And at the Carroll Center, over the years, we had... Yes. Oh, I'm sorry, I've gone off mic. Thank you. At the Carroll Center, over the years, we had really hundreds of small and large, nearly all small groups for adults and larger groups for the teens at the summer camp of social interaction. It was called interpersonal skills classes. And what we would do is we would get together somewhere between 3 and 6 people, and we would role play all kinds of different situations. And you can have no idea how useful that was and how good people would feel really embarrassed at first, you know, about the idea that they were going to role play going to a restaurant or role play going to CVS. And then once they got over the first embarrassment, people will come up with solutions and great phrases and great ways to handle the situation sort of within minutes. Talk about crowdsourcing. It was just amazing. And people also had a great laugh because it's so difficult, you know, going through all these situations where you're always having to tread this careful line and you're always kind of on some kind of psychosocial cliff edge, not knowing what's going to happen next, you know, or not knowing who's in front of you or whether you're jumping the line or whatever it is. So this role-playing was, I thought it was terrific, and I think a lot of other people did too. And then as well as that, I did about 80 mostly long interviews with clients about their social interactions and how many people they mostly met with daily, weekly, how many friends they had that they saw regularly or could phone and talk through things with. So as you all know, it's people of working age and young adults, not that life is easy, but who get most of the funding, and that's become even more so over the last year, that it's more difficult if you're over 55 or 60 or whatever to get any kind of intensive training. So this book, the When You Can't Believe Your Eyes book, is mainly directed to people who are losing sight later in life or in middle life. And also, as everybody knows, about 70% of people who are going to have serious vision loss are age 65 or older. And, of course, this group, especially the way times are looking now, are going to get very little training and probably extremely little intensive training. So the book is mostly intended for that group, but as we all know, and today has proved again, we all are short of some area of information. Most of us, certainly me, are short of some large areas of information. And that great presentation about Ira? Is that how it's pronounced? Yes. You know, just showed the kind of thing that people want information about. It's just almost impossible as a person who's blind to have all the information you want. So this book has ended up being quite short. It's 150 pages. It has 12 chapters. And each chapter is divided into a lot, about a dozen sections, a bit more sometimes, and they're each about a page. And so what it's trying to do is to outline the information you need for all kinds of things, from social things to getting the best attention, you know, whatever it is. And then there are some quite big resource sections for each chapter, and they for more quickly changing things like apps and so on, they refer readers to the website that belongs to the book, but also to obviously other people's websites, other good resources that are online, so that the book hopefully won't get out of date too quickly. So that's the kind of background of the book. These 12 chapters are really following kind of two trajectories. The first one is the kind of what are known as the stages or phases of shock and grief and gradual being ready for change and training and building your skills, and then finally feeling pretty darn good about yourself and understanding how to be assertive. And I'll talk more about that in a minute. And then the other trajectory, so that's the kind of like going down, in that you really have to, if you lose a lot of sight, you really have to kind of go through the grief, which has a whole lot of denial in it, as I'm sure most of us know, and a whole lot of anger, often fury, a lot of fear, a lot of sadness, and then gradual sort of understanding that we can come through this and that we're bigger than this, and that alongside all these losses, there's also, I wouldn't call them gains, but in a way, the loss can open you out to finding that you're actually a bigger person than you thought you were, and that you can have quite a satisfying life. The other trajectory of the book has got 6 or 7 themes, which are just interwoven throughout the book. And the first one and the second one are very close together. The first one is believing in yourself and sticking to that. Because we're a minority and there is prejudice and there is still stigma, especially in the workplace, believing in our value to society, getting help when we, getting the help we need, being determined is hugely important. And the next one is being sure that you get the best and plenty of it, the best medical attention that you can possibly get to, depending obviously on your insurance and so on, but really working. And then the best treatment, finding out about it, the best information that you can. Not allowing yourself, in other words, to get stuck, to say, oh, well, to, just settle for something, but really kind of go for what else could I get trained in? How could I persuade my counselor or whoever it is to give me some training with whatever it is? So getting the very best, and then there is social adaptations, learning skillful social adaptations, so you can go to all various kinds of events and put other people at their ease, feel skilled at knowing how to deal with all kinds of situations, including faking eye contact, doing appropriate facial expressions, and knowing how to prepare ahead so that you can enjoy larger events. And then last but not least is learning to be assertive. And if you kind of don't know much about assertiveness, and I certainly don't know as much as I would like to, it sounds like the job is to be loud and bossy, where I'm sounding right now. But actually, assertiveness, if you look at it from a psychological point of view, doesn't mean that at all, although it has some of that in it. Assertiveness gets divided into three. There's being non-assertive or passive, which means that you mask or restrain your own feelings and wishes. And then there's being aggressive, which is forcing your own feelings and wishes onto other people. And then there's being assertive, which is understanding your own feelings and wishes and also listening and working out a reasonable solution so that other people's wishes and feelings are also cared for. And this is a very skillful thing. So my first idea that it was going to be, you know, that phrases, knowing, say, the 10 best phrases to get, you know, to get through certain situation, that's not rubbish. And in my book, there are certain what to do and what to say little sections, but that's mostly for people who just haven't thought about this before, just to get them started. Because in the end, assertiveness, when you come to think about it, is a whole lot about tone, about timing, about how you're going to state something. I mean, just to give an example, I broke my arm about 5 weeks ago, and when I was on public transport recently, I needed to sit down because I wasn't very safe standing up with a bag and a cane and only one arm, and I didn't want anybody to bang into my arm. And so, I mean, if you just think about the sentence, I need to sit down, which is perfectly true, you can say that in so many ways, some of which are aggressive, some of which you kind of mutter under your breath and nobody hears, and some of which are kind of all right to say, you know. So anyway, assertiveness, I do recommend as a study for all of us that to really learn the skills and the compassion that goes with being assertive and taking care of your own feelings and wishes, remembering to believe in yourself and stick to it, but also taking care of other people. So that's it. That's the book, When You Can't Believe Your Eyes, and it will be out in about a year. And I'm hoping you've got lots of questions.
Hannah, my name is Mary. I'm from Worcester. I had a question about some recommendations you would have for navigating a little larger family gathering. When you talk, you mentioned fake eye contact, which I'm not from, well, maybe I'm familiar with and I just didn't know it, but just some ideas you have on that kind of setting.
Large family gatherings are amazingly difficult, and often they're the pits, you know. It's really, I think, people who would come to the Carroll Center who are fairly new to vision loss, they would think that they were, and me too, back in the day, they would think they were going to enjoy the big family holiday party. And they'd come back with really sad stories. So, first of all, the fact that you know everybody doesn't really help all that much. In fact, it can, I think holiday events can make things really awkward because they really kind of remind you of your losses. I think that this is one where you're going to use what I call the three P's, which is prioritize, plan, and phone or text, depending which you're more comfortable with. So you're going to prioritize. You're going to say to yourself, is this family party something that I genuinely want to go to? do I see what would be good for me in this party? What, and really sort of make a little list of the things you want to achieve. You know, you want to talk to certain people or do whatever. And then you're going to plan, and that would include taking something yourself so you're considered part of the party. It might be you take booze, or it might be you take a pie, or whatever seems right to you. But definitely be part of the givers of the party, and try phone the host, whoever that is, and really get a sense of who's going to be at the party. Ask who's going to be at the party, and then see who can give you a ride from that group. And then when you arrive with that person, tell that person that you would like them to keep an eye on you, please, because big parties are tricky. And would they, depending on your level of confidence, would they check on you every few minutes? Or could you sit next to them to have the meal, whatever that is? So you kind of get them so you can't have a terrible time because you've got them on side. And then when you arrive, they can help you find the bathroom. Well, you might know the house well anyway, but you definitely want to have a companion at a big event, because knowing everybody doesn't mean a thing if you haven't fixed something. If it's a really big party, I would say that for every 20 people, you need another helper. This isn't the way everybody would do it, but it's the way I do it at something I really care about. So I would involve one person for an hour, and then I'd move on to another person if it was something I really, really wanted to go to. But I think the hardest thing is to accept that big family parties are really hard work and really difficult, and you have to work at it. And make sure you get the help you need.
Hello, this is Sharon. And
hi, Sharon.
Hi. To that point, I just want to say that I did this one time at a funeral. I asked somebody to be with me because I knew that there was going to be a lot of emotion, my own and other people's in my family, and they weren't paying any attention to me, not because they didn't care about me, but just because they were in themselves.
Yes.
And that having that person allowed me to walk around and greet people. It helped me with the reception afterwards, the food, the whole thing. I just felt so liberated to have somebody with me.
Yes.
And it's a big thing to ask, especially in an emotional situation. But I like your idea at a party of having a few people on call, sort of.
Yes, a couple of people.
For me, anyway, yeah. I find that the worst ones are the weddings where it's really loud.
Oh.
It's just impossible.
Weddings are the kiss of death. Funerals are much better than weddings, I tell you.
Except if they're Irish funerals.
Yeah. I mean, not obviously if your own emotions are very much involved in the death of the person. That I don't want to minimize that in any way, but there's something about weddings which is very visual, you know. And so I would, if you are going to a wedding, I would see if you can find a way to ask the bride, if you care about this, which women often do, men not so often. If there's another time you could see her dress and the bridesmaids' dresses up close, touch them, you know, whatever. If you could have a little minute before or after the ceremony where you can do that. And also, people's egos get really kind of inflated at weddings, and they forget to look after you, I think, much more than at funerals, where they're more sympathy and compassion are in evidence. But either way, I think weddings are really quite difficult. And it's that and holiday parties are the ones you hear the most. I have heard the most horror stories about.
So sticking with the idea of a large gathering, I'm T.C. Brazil. I'm here with my daughter, Sydney Brazil Davis, who is deafblind but oral. And she loves a party. The why, I'm not sure. And I'm always torn between, if I stick right with her to facilitate communication, it seems that people don't come over because they're just not drawn. But if I walk away from her for a bit, and sometimes more than a bit, sometimes it takes a while, people tend to go over to her because they see she's alone. So I'm always torn about, you know, which way to go with that. What's your insight?
I do think that when anybody sees that a person with a serious disability it has a companion, they immediately switch off all sense of personal responsibility. So, Sydney, the more that you can, for instance, I was sitting next to you for part of lunch, and I think people are quite shy to approach somebody, and you were working with a device there at lunch, and I wasn't quite sure if you were listening to something on your device and therefore didn't want to be approached, or if you were wanting to be approached. And I think that we, as the disabled people, have to be brave enough to initiate a conversation. Just to turn to me and say, hello, I'm Sydney. You know, then we could have had a chat, which I would have loved. What do you think, Sydney? Yeah, it's really hard. I mean, the first 50 times are the worst. It is really hard. But people are often willing to be kind and interested for a few minutes, but you have to reach out. You have to take that step, which is quite frightening sometimes. That my piece of advice to you, Sydney's mother, is that Sydney should get to as many programs for young adults as possible so that she feels, and that you gradually slip more and more into the background. Because without putting too fine a point on it, you are going to age.
Already missed that boat.
And Sydney needs to be as skilled and as confident as she possibly can be before you become frail.
I keep telling her that.
Well, you have to act on it, I think. Yeah, it's very difficult. And congratulations, I'm sure you're doing a great job. But back off, I think, is the general thing.
Yeah. So kind of in along the same vein, like when you're dealing with you know, situations like especially at, like at the airport and whatnot. Oh, can you guys, sorry. Yeah. Yep. So especially like in areas like airports and large places like that, you get people who just insist on talking to the people around you. Like, for instance, I was at the airport a couple of weeks ago, and you know, I was on vacation. And, you know, a staff came over and was trying to, you know, was trying to make sure that we got on our flight. And immediately she's like, oh, yeah, you know, like, do you need a wheelchair? Like, immediately she asked that. And then, but she didn't say it to me. She said it to my mother. And needless to say, I was kind of embarrassed because it's like really? If you're going to ask a question like that, you should ask me that. Don't ask the person around me. And it's like,
yes. I missed your name. Could you say it again?
What? Catherine Moss.
Oh, Catherine. Okay. So I think the thing is that eye contact. Sorry?
You know me.
Oh, what's your last name?
Moss.
Oh, hi, Catherine. Yes, indeed. Absolutely. Yep.
So long ago.
Yeah, no, not, I remember hearing how well you were doing. I was very thrilled. Eye contact is a very powerful thing, and at the beginning of interactions, people who see well or reasonably well often start, especially casual interactions with people you don't know, like at the airport, they start by making eye contact. So the first person you have to train is your mother. You say to her, Mom, could you, if somebody speaks to you instead of to me, could you just look down or look away and leave it to me? It's not up to the airline person to be good at blindness. It's up to us. And this is where you need the confidence. So you have to train your mother, and then you speak up to the airport person and say, no, I don't want a wheelchair, thanks. I can just take your elbow, or whatever it is you say. But there's nothing that we can do about the power of eye contact except train the people who love us enough to make things better for us. Yes. Yes. It's quite hard work. And, you know, you didn't think when you were inadvertently turned out to be a person with a major disability that you were going to have to go on teaching people, like, all the time, and that you can't stop. It's such a pain, you know. Yeah. Yeah. Yep, absolutely. Ask her. Yep.
Hannah, this is Bruce Howell.
Hi, Bruce.
Hi, how are you? Just a question that I've run into recently. So sometimes I would be willing to volunteer at events that are not specifically hosted by organizations like this, where there's the expectations for how people behave around the blind, but they're more sighted events. And I guess one of the things that I've thought about recently is that it's really inherent on me to make some advance communications with the person running the program to see how I may be able to participate and be helpful. Just like to get your thoughts on that, please.
Yes, and I want to say that I think that one thing that's really good for all of us to try to do is find an area, not when you're very new to blindness, you know, not when awful things are happening at home, but or whatever, or you have other illnesses. But in general, if you can find a way to volunteer yourself, your own services, it's very good for your sense of yourself. You know, if you look around for somewhere that you could assist, I don't want to go into too much detail right now, but so, Bruce, can you ask your question in a little more detail, just so I get the kind of setting that it might be?
Yeah, absolutely. So in my church, one of the major fundraising missions-oriented things we do is we sell pumpkins in the month of October, and this consists of two huge truckloads arriving. And it's a big church-wide effort to get out there to offload the pumpkins off the truck and get them set up in the yard where they're going to be sold. And I always picture this as being such a visual thing that I never feel like there's any way that I could really be a part of this, yet it's something that a major segment of the church gets involved with, so I feel kind of left out that I don't do anything. And so this fall, after the event, I was speaking to one of the chairpersons, and she said, oh, I wish you'd talk to me first, because maybe you could have been up in the truck where we literally had this chain going of somebody handing a pumpkin down off the pile to the next person, and I wouldn't have had to be jumping in and out of the truck. I wouldn't have had to be trying to maneuver a wheelbarrow, but I certainly could have been a part of a human chain had I realized and thought about it in advance.
Yes. So thank you, Bruce. So this is very good. So if you have an organization that you belong to, which has a volunteering or a religious or a whatever mission, it's terrific to get hold of someone who is in charge of some aspect of it and ask exactly what they do. Now, you are the person who's going to know how you can contribute, but you won't know how you can contribute until you find out exactly what they do. So you have to kind of get someone on one side and say, okay, can you describe to me what that consists of? And then you can say, oh, well, I can be part of the human chain. Or you can say, oh, well, I could help out at the whatever. If you're looking for a place to begin this, religious and charitable organizations are sometimes a good place to begin. Also, it's often good to think about hospitals, nursing homes, maybe day programs for people, anything like that where, if certainly as a beginner at volunteering, where the staff are going to be more accustomed to making life easy for someone with a disability. You don't want to start off. You want to start off with a success in order to encourage yourself to do it again, you know. And that means go where someone is accustomed to disability and will encourage you and help you out a bit. I really recommend that as a way, because we all have to accept help from others. So it's great to, you know, complete the circle, give back in whatever way you can. It makes you feel good.
Bruce, next year when you do that, borrow Brian's tie.
Hi, my name is Rose, but really Rosemary Miller, and I have a question about buffets, and I know you mentioned something about, you know, employing a friend.
Sorry, but, Rose, can you speak into the mic? I missed the important word.
I have a question about buffets.
Oh,
so
buffet.
If you go
oh,
out
God.
To eat, and so... I know you said employ a friend, but a lot of times the friend will only pick the food that they like.
Yes.
So what do you do about that?
Well, buffets are the kiss of death, as we all know. The important thing is to, having got your friend, you do not sit. You go with the friend and you hold your own plate and you keep asking her or him. You keep saying, oh, what's in this next dish? Oh, no, I'm not so keen on that. But don't sit at the table, because then all the decisions are made by the friend. I have to tell you that I have twice recently, well, in the last couple of years, made the same mistake. You'd think you'd learn. I belong to a meditation group, and I have twice put my hand right into a huge bowl of yogurt, thinking it was napkins. And the person who was helping me thought it was absolutely hilarious. She was leaning against the wall. She was laughing so much. I was less tickled by this. So, yes, buffets are very awkward.
Yeah, but, I did it with artichoke dip.
Yes, exactly. They're much easier if it's just finger food. And then you can, if you can get your friend to tell you that it's finger food, just one little tip, which I learned from somebody, I think from Deanne, actually, years ago, which is if it's cookies or if somebody's passing something around on a plate and you can bring your hand up from underneath, not hard, of course, feel your way to the rim, and then you can creep your fingers over the rim and pick up the outside cookie. This helps you not put your hand down in the middle of something like the yogurt, so that other people aren't kind of sort of horrified by watching you feel all over the top of something. So if you come up from underneath and feel around the edge, that can prevent some of that. Another way of doing it, of course, is just to ask the organizer to put a little plate full aside for you. I mean, although vision loss and other attendant losses like hearing loss are, you know, a series of extreme losses. There's no two ways, with a whole lot of effects. There are certain pluses which we all use, you know, and which it's okay to use, provided you don't kind of overdo it and become a real pest. But so, you know, if you go up to somebody who's, if you find out, you know, it's all about preparedness. If you find out who's organizing the buffet, if you're in that position, which you might not be, you can then ask someone to put something aside for you that you would like. I do want to say that when you're practicing this stuff, it's really good to start with people who are paid to help you. So, like, the assistant in a store or the person at the medical facility, you can practice various lines on them, and they are paid to assist you. Your family and friends are far harder work, usually. Because families, you know, are like big old ships. They change very slowly, and you have to really work at that firm, you know, stuff. And sometimes people are in situations, unfortunately, not very rarely, in situations where it's really not safe for them to be assertive, where, you know, some kind of abuse might take place. So if you think you might be in that situation, please do reach out for help to the Commission for the Blind or whatever. Yeah, it's good to practice this stuff on paid assistants. And then when you've worked out some things that work, then you can start in on the friends and family. And, of course, the thing really about friends is that they're, on the whole, sighted friends find it very difficult to remember that you can't see. They just can't remember. And occasionally you find a friend who does, but on the whole, most people just forget. They just can't get it into their heads, let alone the implications of that, you know. My cousin, who I love, my best cousin, said to me, "Oh, don't you know that?" She said it's on every prescription label. And this was about feeling nauseous if you didn't eat some food with painkillers. And I was like, she doesn't know that I can't read medication labels? You know, it just, the implications of sight loss just don't strike people, which you know much better than I do. Anyway, anything else? I've lost track of time. Yeah.
Hannah, this is David Kingsbury.
Yeah.
First off, thank you for what you said about Deanne. Now I know why all my cookies are disappearing on me all the time. yes, but where's my cookie right now? Okay. Well, other than that, a very simple question. You said the book is coming out in a year or so.
Yes.
What are your plans for that coming out in accessible format?
Okay, so the book will begin in four formats. It will be in regular print. Then you can get a CD with a large print version. Then there's an ordinary e-book, which is not accessible. And then mine is the first book that Charles Thomas has ever published, which has an accessible version, which is an EPUB version, which will be available on Google Play.
Hannah?
Yes.
I'd like to return to the buffet for a minute.
Yes, please.
Okay. No, my lunch was good. Here's another permutation that I've... No more cookies. No more cookies, okay. That I've come across where I've been at, a business meeting. Somebody helps me to get my food, sits me down at a table, and disappears.
Oh, yes.
And I'm at the table by myself.
Oh, yes.
And it's happened to me numerous times. And I've started now to say to people, I really would like to sit with some people, so please
right.
put me with somebody. Because, Right. You get to feel invisible after.
Yeah, it's horrible. Yeah, and sometimes, I mean, that can be very awkward. I quite agree. I've been in similar situations. I'm afraid it's all about jolly old preparation. If you're going to this meeting, you have to think who you're most comfortable with, who's also going. So you sometimes go to meetings where you don't know anyone? Well, then following Deanne, who is my guide in social cleverness, often you slip one of the waiters $5 or 10 if you're feeling rich to help you, but that doesn't get you someone to sit with. I think that when you're in the line, you have to strike up a conversation, but I do agree. I think that that's almost an unsolvable problem, going to a meeting where you would like to meet someone, but you don't already know. And I'd be very grateful if somebody's got a solution to that. It seems to me very tricky.
Hannah, we're at time.
So oh, okay.
Hannah, it's Jennifer. So just one quick idea for that I tried and it worked was there was someone I really did want to meet. I knew it ahead of time. I emailed her, and we set up a time that we could meet, a place to meet. And we also exchanged cell phone numbers. So I texted her to say, hey, I'm in the room, and we were able to connect. Now, it
yes.
doesn't always work that smoothly, but you talk about advanced preparation.
Yes.
And, you know, to me, that's always the hardest part to do because I'll just wait until the last minute. But kind of identify, like, the three most important things you want to accomplish wherever you're going.
That's
and
right.
Focus on those things.
Yes. And prioritize comes into this a lot because you have to let go of quite a lot of kind of smaller things that would be really nice. But you have to think, okay, what do I really want to accomplish? But I do agree. I didn't get the name of that previous speaker, but I do agree with that person that going to a meeting, if there's any way you can find a few names in advance and email somebody, I would really push the boat out on that, so at least you have somebody to sit with. And I have to stop, so thank you all very much.
One more question. Could you say the name of your book?
Yes, it's called, the book is called When You Can't Believe Your Eyes, and the subtitle is Vision Loss and Personal Recovery. And my name is Hannah, H-A-N-N-A-H, Fairbairn, F-A-I-R-B-A-I-R-N. And the publisher is Charles C. Thomas. Thank you all very much.
Well, that'll just about do it for this month's edition of Council Connection. If you have any questions or comments about the show, please leave us a message in the BSCB mailbox at 617-923-4519. I'm your host, Steve Dresser, hoping that you'll stay warm during this cold weekend and join us again in February for another edition of Council Connection. Take care.